Okay, as we draw to the end of the book of Jeremiah, we're going to be looking at the last chapter tonight, which is an appendix, and then we're going to look at the first chapter of Lamentations, an introduction to Lamentations in the first chapter. And then the Lord being willing, and we'll depend on how time goes, we'll look at chapters 2 and 3 on Sunday and chapters 4 and 5 on the final class next Wednesday. Okay? So let's begin by looking at Jeremiah chapter 52, but we need to begin in chapter 51, the last verse of chapter 51. You'll see there's a little statement that's made right at the end of the chapter. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah. And so here's a note that indicates the part that Jeremiah wrote ends here. Well, what about chapter 52? We put on your lesson something relative to the colophon principle. A colophon is not anything unusual in writing. It's an addition or a footnote, information that's put, some kind of notation oftentimes at the end of a book about its publication or possibly other things about the book. We're not saying this is that it's about its publication and all, but it's that principle that someone else, a later hand, would attach some note at the end of the book. Now, in the Old Testament, this was not uncommon at all. And they used it to tie their Old Testament books that were in their canon together. Let me illustrate. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 32. I mean 34, excuse me. 34. And so here's Deuteronomy 34. We know Moses wrote the first 5 books of your Bible. But it seems Moses didn't write chapter 34. Why? Because you see it says verse 5, Moses the servant of the Lord died there in the land of Moab. Verse 6, and God buried him in the valley of the land of Moab. And then there's a statement about his age. And then verse 9, you move on to Joshua. So Moses is dead and buried. And now he begins to talk about Joshua. Well, the very next book, so in the Hebrew Bible, you had the law, the Torah, or the Pentateuch. The next book would be Joshua. And so your next book is about Joshua. And so the end of Deuteronomy, there's a footnote or notation that ties it to the next canonical book or inspired book. So then you get to the end of the book of Joshua. And if you look in Joshua chapter 24, there's a statement about Joshua's last address. But then in verse 29, it says Joshua died being 110 years old. They buried him, verse 30. But then there's a statement in 31. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua. Then there's a couple of verses about Joseph and Eleazar, which is not necessarily relating to the material in Joshua, but you have this later note. So you look at that verse 31 of Joshua 24 and turn over to Judges chapter 2. So Judges, Ruth, those were together as one book, is the next book in their Bible. Look at Judges chapter 2, verse 7. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua. That's what you read over there Joshua 24. And so you see that note was added later by a later prophet, but it ties it to Judges. Go to Judges Ruth. Like I say, that would be one book in their Bible, Judges Ruth. And you go to the end of the book of Ruth, and you get to chapter 4, and you'll note it began to talk about Boaz taking Ruth and her, and Ruth having a son, and you get down to verse 17, began to trace the lineage. They named him Obed. He's the father of Jesse, the father of David. So that's projecting on down through the years. What's the next book in your Bible? 1 Samuel. What's it about? David. And so you see this all the way through. So when you get to 2 Kings, and you look at 2 Kings 25, verse 27 through 30, you see this moving on down, verse 27, in the 37th year of the exile. So he's moving 37 years down the stream of time, and in this notation. And what's interesting about that, go to Jeremiah chapter 52 and verse 31. We ask you this on your lesson. If you look at, I didn't put the chapter, did I? Y'all probably wondered, what in the world? I just now see that mistake. The last line there, 52, 31 through 34, compared with 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30. And so you start at 2 Kings 25, 27, came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, etc. You get to Jeremiah 52, 31, it came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Three verses in both places, same thing. And so indication that a later prophet, likely the same prophet, put these notation, Jeremiah may have been the one who wrote Kings. But be that as it may, you have a notation by some prophet that was put at the end of this book. Don't know who wrote Kings. But anyway, you see the connection there. So in these verses we gave you, there's further indication. It's very clear in 51:64 that there's a line being drawn, a division being made. This is the end of Jeremiah's writing. So when you start in chapter 52, verses 1 through 16, and you go back and read Jeremiah 39, 1 through 10, my question may not have been clear. I knew exactly in my mind what I wanted you to see. Anybody figure out what we're looking for in these verses?
Similar to identical accounts.
Okay, so they're either identical or very similar. Now, the last one I just mentioned, they're identical. 52, 1 through 16, 39, 1 through 10. Much of what's in 52, 1 through 16 is in 39, 1 through 10. There's some additional information. The point is, why would Jeremiah, if he's already written it, write it again? But he didn't. It's the indication, at least, that it's a later prophet that put this information in chapter 52 and elaborated a bit with some additional information. In 52, 1 through 3, with 2 Kings 24, 18 through 20, did you note the similarity? Those are actually identical. And then 52, 4 through 9, compared with 2 Kings 25, 1 through 6. Now note, there's six verses in both of those references. You go compare those verses, and you're going to see the similarity. Now I stopped at verse 9 in chapter 52 because in 52, 10... And if you want to go back to 2 Kings 25, verse 6 of 2 Kings 25, then they captured the king and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and he passed sentence on him. That's like Jeremiah 52:9. But then, Jeremiah 52:10, the king of Babylon slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and in 2 Kings 25, you have that same thing. But then there's some additional information over here in Jeremiah. And he also slaughtered all the princes of Judah in Riblah. That's not in 2 Kings. And then again, then he blinded the eyes of Zedekiah, and the king of Babylon bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon. Well, that's over in 2 Kings 25:7. You have that. But in Jeremiah 52, you have some added information and put him in prison until the day of his death. That's not in 2 Kings 25. And so, in this later hand that was written, we have some added information. So, the main thing I wanted to do is just make you aware that these writers, the Old Testament writers, that this was a principle, that a later hand, a later prophet would add some kind of notation having to do with either the data in that book or some later data that would take place chronologically. So don't let 51:64 be an alarm to you. Say, what's the deal? I thought Jeremiah wrote Lamentations. Yes, he did up to this point. That's not uncommon. Moses wrote the Pentateuch up to chapter 34. So that's to the Jews, they would be very familiar with this. It would not be a strange thing at all. To us, it may be a strange thing. So that may be helpful to you. I don't know. I know it was helpful to me when I learned about this principle of the Old Testament writings. Any questions or comments about that before we move on to Lamentations? All right, let's move on to the book of Lamentations tonight. Our study of Lamentations is a little bit different than I did in Jeremiah. Partly because just the nature of the book. You'll notice like tonight we've got one chapter. Next class we're going to try to look at two chapters. That's going to be a bit of a challenge because as you note on the sheet, you've got five chapters. And by the way, as far as the authorship, Jeremiah's name never appears in the book. But the Septuagint, which was 150, 250 years before Christ, attributes the authorship to Jeremiah. And then, as you see on your lesson, Jewish and Christian writers of the early centuries after Christ did so. And you can go search that out if you wish. So that was commonly held, that Jeremiah was the author of Lamentations. And, of course, we've already seen in the book of Jeremiah why he was called the weeping prophet, because of the laments that were in the book of Jeremiah. And so this book, Book of Lamentations. So, you got five poems in the book. And that's the five chapters. Now, my Bible, I'm reading from the New American Standard Version. And you know that, of course, the publishers of a Bible will print it based on what they think either the proper divisions are. For example, in my Bible, as you go through any chapter, when there's a different paragraph, they'll put a bold number. Say, oh, this is a new paragraph. Is it? Well, you can decide that. Sometimes they'll put a space between paragraphs to alert the reader that something's different. Did Jeremiah do that or Paul do that? No, that's not the point. That's not to say that. It's that's their judgment about that. But sometimes that's helpful. And this Bible doesn't, you look at it, you probably never guess that there are 22 stanzas, poetic stanzas, and these correspond to the 22 verses. And you'll see that I have on the lesson that in the Hebrew alphabet, there were 22 letters. And the 22 stanzas correspond to the 22 letters. We do that, we call it an acrostic, where every word begins with a different letter of the alphabet. So if you could read Hebrew and had the Hebrew text, each verse would begin with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. That's the poetic nature of that. Psalm 31, about the virtuous woman, verse 10 through the end of that, is that kind of poetry. So it's not uncommon in their literature. But this is all through the book of Lamentations. So as you see on the notes, chapters 1, 2, 4, and 5 have 22 verses, 22 stanzas. You get over to chapter 3, it's different. When you look at chapter 3, you'll see that there are 66 verses. Well, why 66? Because in this chapter, three verses began with the same Hebrew letter. So 3 times 22, 66. That's why you get 66 verses. And so if you could read Hebrew, the first three verses begin with the same Hebrew letter. The next three verses with the next Hebrew letter. Now, to appreciate that, I put on your lesson that if you have a King James Version bound edition, I don't know that your digital copy will do this. And I suggest if you use an iPad or a Kindle or your computer or whatever to study, that's okay. But at least in my opinion, it will not replace the need for a bound edition. And you need to have handy on your desk or right by your desk or wherever you study some bound editions of the New American or the New King James or both, whatever you study from. It'd be good to have a bound edition of the American Standard. Why? Several reasons. One, your digital will not show you the footnotes oftentimes that the translators have put in there. And those footnotes are sometimes very, very valuable. And the bound edition, of course, if you got a good reference Bible, will give you the references. Some digital copies have it if you know how to use it. But there's a third reason. That's the one we're talking about now. It's the formatting. Rocky taught Isaiah, for example. And so you say, I'm going to read Isaiah and get ready for this study. Good. Here's a suggestion when you study Isaiah. Go read it in the New International Version. Whoa, I didn't think you liked that verse. Not as a text to study from, but because the formatting is different. The paragraphing is different, and it'll make you stop and think. That's why. And so if you have the New King, anybody have the New King James bound? You have it. Did you see what I was talking about, the spaces? So after, on the four chapters, after each verse, there's a space, right? But when you get to the third chapter, it's after the third verse, right? And so that shows you that. If you're looking for that, you can see, well, why did they do that? There's a reason they did that. And so a bound edition can help with that. And you'll notice we have the ESV and the NIV. They also have printed it to help the reader with that. So that's just something to be aware of. It's just a tool in your Bible study that might be of help to you as you go through. Now, obviously, since it is poetry, you can expect a lot of imagery, poetic license, if we call it sometimes. And that's going to be certainly true in this book. And then, I mentioned about the acrostic. And the first four. The first four acrostics following the order of the Hebrew alphabet. But evidently, chapter 5 doesn't follow the order. It does use the Hebrew alphabet, but doesn't follow the order. So you never have to, that won't even be a footnote on your final test and when you get to heaven. So don't worry about it. But it's just something to be aware of, okay? Now, you'll note this last paragraph before we get to chapter 1. The first four chapters are dirges. We don't use that word too much, so I put our laments. And then it's something often associated with a funeral, sorrow, something very tragic that's happened. And the last chapter is a prayer of lament. We'll see that when we get to chapter 5, if the Lord is willing. So that's what we're going to be dealing with as we look at the book of Lamentations. So our challenge tonight is to look at chapter 1. Now, we had suggested you do marking. Now, you may not have been doing that on Jeremiah, and that's okay, and you don't have to do it here. But our study in this class is going to be drawn from the flow of thought that really stands out when you see the word threads through the chapters. And the way that you can do that, at least has been very helpful to me. And I would read it and I would look for these related families of words. And I did it several times on the iPad that I study on before I would do it in my Bible. After we gave you extra sheets to do it on. That you could do it on a sheet of paper and come back and read it again, you'd probably change it. after having done this several weeks ago, I've changed it, and I went back tonight, restudying, changed it again. Changed the marking. And that says another thing. There's no right and wrong way to mark it. My guess is, if we went through this class right now, I know some of you did mark it. And if we were to go and say, let's compare papers, we'd probably not find any two exactly alike. Oh, well, then they got an A, they got a B. No, nothing like that. This is just a tool to help. The more you do it, the more it can be a tool to help you. Some people don't like to do marking. If you don't, that's okay. We're not going to withdraw from you. It's okay. But I'm just suggesting it as a tool for Bible study. Okay? And I'm not the only one that marks. If you want to see Wally's Bible, he can show it to you, or Pat's Bible, or Rocky's, or others. There's other people here that do that and find it useful in their Bible study. So I think it's very helpful in the book of Lamentations. So if you want to see later, of course, didn't make them to hand out, but I've got some samples up here later after we dismiss or something, if you want to look at kind of what it looks like on mine. Doesn't mean it's going to look like that on yours, of what I did in my marking, but you can maybe get a glimpse of what I'm talking about by looking at this, okay? All right, so we had suggested, and the title of each chapter, again, that's arbitrary. I tell you what you'll find. You can go through different commentaries or different Bible summaries or different books written about Jeremiah. You're going to find different titles or headings given to each chapter in all those various resources. I know because I've done it. And so what you do, you read the chapter, and you, if you want to entitle it something, then you choose something that kind of fits as best you can the scope of the chapter. So I chose the deserted widow in my Bible that I'm looking at before I had written Jerusalem, the afflicted woman. So you can see even I changed. But what we put on your lesson is the deserted widow. And as I read it and reread it, I was impressed with the sadness of this picture that's being presented of a woman, a widow, deserted with nobody to help her. It's very impressive, I think, poetry here in chapter 1. But we had suggested that you mark the geographical notes throughout the chapter. And why that's helpful, it tells you what he's talking about. I realize, and Rocky wrote me about this, and he's right. I'll tell you geographical indicators when actually I'll mark words that have to do with the nation itself, like Judah. I do that because it tells me who's being spoken of, Judah, Edom, Philistia, whatever it may be. And again, that's a kind of a personal preference on that. But as I go through the chapter, for example, the first thing I see is talking about a city. Verse 1, how lonely sits the city. What city would you think he's talking about? Well, if you're familiar with Jeremiah, you already have an idea. But when you get down to verse 4, if you're marking the geographical indicators, it tells you which city. Roads of Zion. What city is that? Jerusalem, right? And then when you get down to verse 7 and 8, you actually have the word Jerusalem in both of those verses. So he starts out with the city, and then he talks about the roads of Zion in verse 4. Verse 6, a very, very common term. We ran across it in Jeremiah over and over again, where a city or a nation is likened unto a woman. And here he says, the daughter of Zion in verse 6. But he tells you who he's talking about, 7 and 8, Jerusalem. And then you get to verse 15. Instead of just Jerusalem, you can see that he's not only talking about the city itself, but it is, of course, the capital, and its destiny affected the entire nation. And here you have the virgin daughter of Judah. Verse 17, you have Zion stretches out her hands. Who's Zion? Jerusalem, this nation, pictured as a woman, suffering, without anyone to help her. She's stretching out her hands. There's no one to comfort her. That's the picture. And so, but then later in verse 17, he uses the term Jacob. So now he's moved up the ladder from Judah to Jacob, who was, of course, Israel, and uses that terminology, and then again Jerusalem in verse 17. So by interchanging these terms throughout the chapter, you know what he's talking about. And you're not even, you don't have to depend on me, you don't have to depend on a commentary, you just know it because you went through and looked for the indicators in the chapter to tell you what this poem is about. Okay, so let's see the picture that's being presented. He said this city was full of people, and it was. It was their capital, it was populous, it was treasured, but note, she has become like a widow. Now, we're familiar with simile, where things are compared, one thing compared to another. She's like a widow. In what way? Lonely. Is a widow lonely? Yes. This city was full of people, but now she's alone, like a widow. But there's more about this widow. Who was once great among the nations, she who was a princess among the provinces. So in my Bible, I mark, has become like a widow. And then I mark, she who was a princess. Now, you may have marked, she was a princess among the nations. That's okay. But we had tried to caution, you can mark too much. And you lose the power of marking to get your attention. So there's no, again, no right and wrong on that. But this widow, what you see is a contrast. This widow was once a princess. Now she's a widow. And more than that, she's become a forced laborer. What a change. Here's a widow who was a princess among the nations. She's alone. She's lonely. And now she's doing forced labor. Isn't that sad? But there's more. No. She weeps bitterly. Now, you could put that whole phrase in the night, but again, trying to conserve your marking so that when you come back and read it 6 months from now, that kind of stands out. So I just put, she weeps bitterly. She weeps bitterly in the night. She's lonely. She's by herself. Instead of the high stakes she once had, she's forced labor. She nobody to be there with her, no one to comfort her. She weeps during the night. And her tears are on her cheeks. She has none to comfort her. But this woman, didn't she have lovers? Oh, yes. We read about that in Jeremiah, started in chapter 2, remember? Though married to God, she was out chasing her lovers all over the place. But among all her lovers, there's nobody to comfort. Where are they now? That's exactly what happens in real life. People chase after somebody, a woman after a man after a woman, who have no moral character, just somebody to satisfy their passion or the here and now, they got something they can give them. And when they get in trouble, I don't know where they're at. Much better to have someone who's faithful and true, who could commit, is committed. But here's what this woman is among all her lovers. All her friends. In my Bible, I put quotes around lovers and friends. There's people you love or that say they love you, but you better be careful. You know, I see these people get on television, actors, sports people. Oh, I love you people. So they don't love you. They love your applause and the money that they make off of you. That's what they love. And so all her quote-unquote friends, where are they now? They've dealt treacherously with her. You're going to see as we go through the poem, they actually become her enemies. What a sad picture of this widow weeping bitterly, nobody to comfort her. All her lovers say, we don't want anything to do with you. Her friends, where are they? Nowhere to be found. Note he says in the last part of verse 2, they have become her enemies. Her lovers and friends, they're now her enemies. Isn't that a sad picture? Verse 3. Judah has gone into exile. So I just marked going into exile. Now you could do the whole phrase, under affliction if you wanted to. I just put going into exile. And under harsh servitude. This exile was harsh servitude. Note she's a forced laborer. We'll see more about that as we go through the poem. She dwells, now if you're doing the geographical markings, here's one of them, among the nations. Where's she at now? Not in Jerusalem. Not in Judah. She's over somewhere else. She's gone to exile. She's been taken away from the comforts of where she used to live, where she was exalted and had all these blessings and treasures. She's among the nations. She's found no rest. All her pursuers have overtaken her in the midst of distress. And so this, in the midst of distress, you might note a little footnote there if you use the New American Standard. And it'll say, are narrow places. The King James Version, I think, does a good job on the translation here. It says, between the straits. So either in war, or if a person is hunting and they want to, in war, capture an enemy, or hunting, capture an animal, they say, man, if I can get them in that little narrow place over there, they can't get out. I'll have them. I got them. That's the picture that's being presented. They got her, and she can't escape. And so her pursuers have overtaken her between the straits. Hold your finger here and go to Deuteronomy 28. Look at Deuteronomy 28:64. So all this happened in the 500s, right? Finally, when the city was breached and the temple destroyed, they were taken captive. About 1,400 years earlier, approximately, Moses wrote this book. He said, verse 64, telling them what's going to happen. Verse 62, if they didn't obey God, here's what's going to happen. The Lord will scatter you, verse 64, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. There you will serve other gods, wood and stone, which you or your fathers have not known. Among these nations you will find no rest. There will be no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despair of soul. So your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you will be in dread night and day, and shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you will say, would that it were evening. In the evening you shall say, would that it were morning. Because of the dread of your heart which you dread, and for the sight of your eyes which you will see. Did the writer of Lamentations have that in mind when he wrote this? Sounds a lot like it. I don't know. But you see God's warning coming to pass. You know, 200 years later, they might have ignored it. 500 years later, they might have ignored it. But God's promises come to pass. People in the New Testament period did the same thing. Peter talks about it. They mocked the idea of Christ coming again to judge the ungodly. Look, it's been all these years, nothing's happened. People do the same thing today. But you can see those warnings being echoed in the reality of their present state. So, verse 4, the roads of Zion are in mourning. Why? Because no one comes to the appointed feast. Can you imagine what it used to be at Passover and Pentecost, the Feast of Tabernacles, when people from all over the country would come bringing their sacrifices and the celebrations to the Lord. What a happy time it was. What a joyous time it was. Nobody. The roads of Zion are in mourning. No one comes to the appointed feast. All her gates are desolate. You know, the elders of the city used to sit at the gates to decide things. Nobody there anymore. The gates are desolate. Her priests are groaning. Her virgins are afflicted. and she herself is bitter. The ESV says, suffers bitterly. So, besides all of the things that he says about the city that's now gone, and part of the suffering, we'll see more about that later, is remembering the past, how good it once was. You remember what Abraham told the rich man? Son, remember. Remember that? Remember? Boy, if we could just blot out our memory. And so here we are living in the United States of America, so blessed, Bibles in hand, education, freedom. What are we doing with it? And so Jerusalem had so much right at its disposal. They had the true prophets, they had the law, they had the history of Moses and the Exodus. Now look at them. They were prosperous, and they were powerful, and they thought they were invincible. Look at verse 5. Her adversaries have become her masters. They actually rule. Her adversaries rule her now. Her enemies prosper. Besides what she's currently suffering, the fact that her enemies are doing so well just adds. It's like driving the knife in and turning it. For the Lord has caused her grief. Note this little statement in verse 5. It recurs throughout this poem, that idea, because of the multitude of her transgressions. Look at verse 8. Jerusalem sinned greatly. Look at verse 14. The yoke of my transgressions is bound by his hand. They are knit together, as if it's a yoke, either made up of the transgressions that God had weaved together, or because of their transgressions, put on their neck. The yoke of my transgressions. Look at verse 18. For I have rebelled against his command. Verse 20, middle of the verse. For I have been very rebellious. Verse 22, next to last line. For all my transgressions. And one of the poems in Lamentation is going to point out that it's good for us to think about that. It can do us actually good to think about where we were, where we are, and why that happened. But certainly that's on the mind of the poet. Marking again in verse 5, I marked those first two things about her adversary. Then at the end of the verse, her little ones have gone astray as captives. What happened to Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego taken off? Fine young men, gone. How many other young children taken away in captivity? Verse 6, all her majesty has departed. Her princes. Note, all I did on that princes statement is I marked her princes and the little phrase have fled. That captures it. Her princes have fled like deer. They're gone. The ones you might look to as a symbol of strength for their country that fled like deer that have no pasture before the pursuer. Verse 7, in the days of her affliction and homelessness, Jerusalem remembers. There's that remembering. Look where I'm at. Look where I was. She remembers all her precious things that were from days of old. When her people fell into the hand of the adversary and no one helped her, the adversary saw her, they mocked at her ruin. So when they fell into the hand of the adversary and nobody came to assist them, their enemy said, ha ha, we're so glad. Good for you. Good for you. They didn't come to show any sympathy or any compassion. They just mocked her ruin. It's bad enough to suffer. But for people to ridicule and shame you and say, you deserved it. I'm glad you got it. 9, toward the end of the verse, it says, "See, O Lord, my affliction, for the enemy has magnified himself." The adversary, how did he magnify himself? Besides what we just read about making fun of him, look at verse 10. "The adversary has stretched out his hand over all her precious things." What precious things? He's going to tell you what precious things. "For she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, the ones whom you commanded that they should not enter into your congregation. All her people groan." Let me stop there. "The ones that should not enter your congregation." So they went into the holy places, took what they wanted. The holy vessels. All that was so precious and sacred. They magnified themselves. Forget the prohibitions that God had put in. And so, verse 11, "The people groan seeking bread." They want something to eat. There's famine. There's starvation. What do they do to get bread? They've given their precious things for food. What would it be like to take, "Boy, I'm so hungry. I've got this wedding ring. I'll sell it for a loaf of bread. I've got these jewels from my mother that I've treasured for years. I've got to eat, and I'll sell it for a loaf of bread." That's the kind of picture that's being presented. And so, I say I'm about out of time, and I didn't make it through chapter 1. But you can go through the rest of chapter 1. You see the kind of things we're doing. Look at verse 16. "For these things I weep, my eyes run down with water, because far from me is a comforter. My children are desolate." Over and over through this chapter, you have this little statement like you have at verse 17. "Zion stretches out her hands, there's no one to comfort her." There's nobody she can turn to. No one. And so, on through the chapter, lamenting the distress. Verse 20. "My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is overturned within me." You know, you just suffer so bad, you just feel like your insides are going to be chewed up. That's the way this woman is. And again in verse 21, they're so glad. But verse 21 and 22, at the end of the chapter, you have one of these imprecatory prayers, asking God to remember her enemies. And and saying that they might become like me. "So remember what they've done to me, Lord." See that imprecatory prayer. Well, my time is up. But you see the kind of thing we're doing. And so, if we have trouble getting through one chapter, how are we going to do through two chapters? But anyway, that's what we're going to try, at least part of chapter 3. So work on chapter 2 and 3 for our next class. Thank you very much.